Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for argument this morning is Judith and Cody Sturzenbecker versus Sioux County Ranch, LLC. Joel Rishi will be arguing on behalf of the appellant Sturzenbeckers. We have Pamela Ryder and Ronald Parsons who are appearing on behalf of Appalese Sioux County Ranch. And Mr. Parsons, I understand he'll be arguing. Okay, each side will have 15 minutes for your argument. And then Mr. Rishi, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal and you can proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joel Rishi. I'm from the Davenport Evans Law Firm in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And as the court mentioned, we represent appellant Sioux County Ranch, LLC in this matter. And I understand that the court wants us to address a jurisdictional question, but before I get to that, I want to stress an important point that I think is key to understanding all the claims in this case. On January 14th, 2021, Judith Sturzenbecker went to her attorney's office in Bridgewater, South Dakota. She sat with her attorney, picked up a pen, and signed the real estate purchase agreement where she promised to sell the land at dispute in this case to Sioux County Ranch, LLC. In fact, she took that pen and she initialed on each of the 12 pages on the line where it says seller's initials. The next day, Sioux County Ranch signed that same agreement, and more than 2 months later, she executed a warranty deed, just as she had promised to do, and delivered it to Sioux County Ranch, transferring ownership of that property. The circuit court below says that real estate purchase agreement does not matter, has no effect on the intent of the parties in this case, and that the intent was something else. When it did that, it disregarded this state law, state statute that says written agreements mean something, and it disregarded this court's years of precedent saying the same thing. And so it erred when it denied the motion for judgment on the pleadings, and the circuit court erred when it granted the motion for a preliminary injunction, and that's why we're here today.
How is that contrary to our precedent that relates to claims in which an equitable mortgage has been claimed, which are essentially our arguments that asking the court to recharacterize the written transactions and to do that by looking at the intent from the inception. And then the exchange for that, of course, you have to carry a high burden of clear and convincing evidence to overcome that. How is that inconsistent with our equitable mortgage cases?
It's inconsistent because when we're looking at the equitable mortgage cases, the instrument that we are recharacterizing is the deed, the instrument transferring conveyances, right?
Well, but some of those cases didn't just have a deed.
That's right, Your Honor.
They had contracts for deed. They had other documents also that were executed, didn't
but
they?
The challenge deed, the first deed, for example, if you look at a case like Myers, the challenge deed was a bare deed, and then there was a contract for deed which explained how the grantor could get the property back in the future. There was no complete written agreement explaining the intent of the challenge deed.
No, but one of those things that's a little bit conspicuous in those cases is that there's no discussion of ambiguity in those equitable mortgage cases. And there didn't seem to be, at least, and maybe I missed it, the cases I looked at in equitable mortgage, there didn't seem to be a discussion of we've got to find an ambiguity in these documents before we look at whether or not this was an equitable mortgage situation.
It's not a question of ambiguity necessarily, Your Honor. It's a question of whether the deed represents a complete understanding of the parties, right? So if it's just a bare deed transferring ownership, I think there is some room for the court to say that's not a complete agreement. It's an instrument. And, you know, if under these equitable circumstances, if there is clear and convincing evidence that suggests that maybe the intent expressed in the warranty deed wasn't the complete intent, then we can utilize the equitable mortgage doctrine. But if there is a complete agreement explaining the party's intent with respect to the challenge deed, not the deed where the parties could ultimately get the property back, such as a contract for deed or a lease agreement with an option, but the challenged deed where the conveyance actually went to, in this case, Sioux County Ranch, then you utilize 53-8-5 that says the intent of the parties controls.
Well, but 53-8-5 talks about, you can't go back and look at negotiations and discussions. And I acknowledge the court did that here. I mean, the court brought in evidence and talked about, allowed the parties to talk about, our negotiations and what we did. But I'm not sure the court really needed to do that in the context of an equitable mortgage, if that's the claim, because that's not what our cases seem to suggest. You're not really looking at negotiations, and frankly, I'm not sure the negotiations made a lot of difference in this case. Instead, you're looking at the documents and the context in which these documents were given, and that's what gives rise to an equitable mortgage. So it almost seems to me 53-8-5 doesn't even apply, because we're not. I know the court said I'm not going to apply 53-8-5, or said this is a case where we can get around that, but I'm not sure the oral negotiations really mattered in this case, did they?
Well, I say of course they didn't, Your Honor, because of the written agreement. But even if you just look at the circumstances with setting aside the oral negotiations, the court below misapplied the Myers factors. And I think a big example of that is the court found in its opinion that the debt was reduced, that the deed was transferred, and it reduced the debt that Judy Sturzenbecker owed to Sioux County Ranch. Now, a security interest does not reduce a debt. A security interest, by definition, secures a debt. It doesn't reduce it. So when the debt reduction occurred, that conclusively shows, I think, that there is no equitable mortgage here. That factor was completely...
Do you need the Myers factors? I mean, if you're right, if you win on the argument that the agreement controls, and our cases are legion that say agreements control, unless they're ambiguous, just apply the agreement. Is it as simple as that?
I think so, Your Honor. I mean, if an equitable mortgage claim is there, then I think what that actually maybe creates is an exception to the doctrine of merger, right, where a deed is intended to convey the entire agreement between the parties.
The essence, as I understand it, of equitable mortgage as a doctrine, an equitable doctrine at that, so there's no legal remedy. We're in equity now. Otherwise, the law and what the law would otherwise provide for by way of a legal remedy is inadequate for one reason or another. And in this instance, there's an effort to divine the intent of the parties at the outset, not later. It's like when the contract for deed comes in later in Myers, Rader. That's later. So it's at the outset.
At the outset of the transaction and not at the outset of the relationship, which I think is a key distinction, right? Because the circuit court below said, well, when they first met, the goal of the Sturzenbeckers was for their family to own the party. But when you look at Myers, that case says at the beginning of the business relationship, at the transaction, when the deed was occurred, that's where the intent is important.
So the question of ambiguity would come in only in a case like this where you have an agreement. Because in many of these instances, at the outset, there isn't one. There's a bare deed, or there's something else that leaves some degree of uncertainty. There's a lack of transparency. So that the court, at a later point in time, can't adequately look to a resource and say, this is what they meant. Because later, everyone disagrees about what they meant.
Right, of course. And the circumstances in this case, obviously, I think there was some regret, but I don't think there's any dispute about what the intent was at the time of the transaction, and I think that's clearly laid out in the real estate purchase agreement, which I do think controls.
So, go ahead.
In order to view that, is the purchase agreement ultimately ambiguous? In order to view this as a true sale, wouldn't we have to conclude that Sioux County loaned Judy $4 million without any collateral and then sold the property back to them, arguably fair, much below market value, and then gave them $1 million without compensation?
No, I don't think you have to conclude that. First of all, the documents show that Sioux County Ranch loaned the $4.25 million with a written mortgage, which was satisfied when she conveyed the property back to Sioux County Ranch. Secondly, she conveyed to them the property, but that property, when she conveyed it, was encumbered by the lease and the option to Cody Sturzenbecker. So what did Judy get for her just over $1 million? She got the opportunity for her son to someday own this property if he satisfied those conditions. That was the goal from the outset. So Did she get something for her $1 million? Yes. But more importantly, was she a competent adult who was represented by counsel who is capable of making that decision and whether it was a smart move or not? Yes. And is it this court's or any other court's role to go back and give these parties a do-over, a mulligan, when things don't turn out as they hope? I don't think so. The contract controls. And I do want to address jurisdiction very briefly, if the time permits, Your Honors. So we have appealed this as a matter of right under Section 3 of the Appellate Procedure, Rules of Appellate Procedure. Under Subsection 5 of that, an order which grants, refuses, continues, dissolves, or modifies the remedy of an injunction is appealable as a matter of right. The question I see it is, what does the order constitute? Is it the whole written order, the whole written document that was issued by the court putting into effect this decision? Or is it the discrete part of the order now where the court addresses the injunctive relief?
This is an order. This isn't a final judgment. The reason why it's appealable as an interlocutory matter is under subsection 5 because it deals with an injunction. But there is another component that the parties have set out in their briefs, and that's the discrete order denying the motion for judgment on the pleadings. I don't think there's a real question that there's jurisdiction to consider the injunction part. The question really is there a jurisdiction to consider the denial of a motion for judgment on the pleadings, which is otherwise interlocutory, is not final. There's no discretionary sort of request to review it. So that, is that reviewable?
Yes, because it's in the order which grants the injunctive relief.
And what is your authority for that?
The same statute, because...
But how does denial of the motion for judgment on the pleadings affect the injunction a lick?
Well, it does, because if the motion for judgment on the pleadings hadn't been denied, we wouldn't have gotten to the motion for preliminary injunction, first of all. Secondly, necessarily affecting is the standard that's in place for a final judgment. But
this
isn't
a final judgment.
That's right. It's an order. So if you, alternatively, if you don't think it just falls into the, it is in this order that is being appealed rationale, under Section 10 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure, a court can review any matter relating or that is relevant to the order, right? And that relevant to language is necessarily broader than the necessarily affecting language in the final judgment jurisdictional statutes, right? So is it relevant to the order? Well, yes, it has overlapping legal questions. It has overlapping factual allegations. It was addressed in the same hearing by the same judge in the same order, in the same memorandum opinion. You know, if you think of relevance, you think of does it have any tendency to bear on a fact of consequence? And I think if, you know, for example, there is a plausible claim for relief on unconscionability, that has to bear on whether a preliminary injunction is granted in this case or not, regardless of whether they argued that that was the basis for their preliminary injunction. So I think it just falls in the plain language of Section 3 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure. But if not, it certainly falls into Section 10. And if you look at how the federal courts apply their jurisdictional statutes, which have similar language, the federal courts have long held that a court can address the entire order, not just the propriety of the injunctive relief. And you can look at a case like Gaines v. Sunray Oil Company, which is an Eighth Circuit case from 1976 at 539 Fed 2nd, 1136. And in fact, in a 2011 decision, Bacon v. Near, which is at 631 Fed 3rd, 875, the Eighth Circuit ruled that the order denying injunctive relief was moot, and then went on to address whether there were plausible claims for relief anyway, and ultimately, I believe, dismissed the case. So there is, I think, statutory jurisdiction for this court under the plain reading of the statutes, and I think there is support for that, how it's consistently held in the federal courts, and it makes sense. You know, why would the parties want to go through the judicial resources to litigate a claim that won't be affected by any discovery. These are legal arguments that are presented by the record that this court could address today and save the risk of having multiple appeals, save the parties additional litigation. So I think that the statutes provide the jurisdiction for this court to address all the issues that have been brought in our appeal. When it comes down to it, Your Honors, I think the question really is, are these contracts, do they mean something or don't they? And in this case, I think they do, right? This contract clearly expresses Judith Sturzenbecker's intent to convey the property to Sioux County Ranch. That's what she did, and the circuit court erred below when it ruled that some other intent based on their testimony and other factors could replace that, could recharacterize, could reimagine that agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rishi. Mr. Parsons, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court and my friend, Mr. Rishi. I thought I would start with the issue flagged by this court on whether the denial of the motion for judgment on the pleadings itself is an appealable order. I agree with the second analysis, the alternative analysis that's was put forward by my friend. It's clearly not an appealable order unless there's a discretionary grant. Subsection 7 doesn't apply because it's not a judgment, as you mentioned, Justice Salter, but Subsection 10 says that when an appeal is from any order subject to an appeal, the Supreme Court may review all matters appearing on the record relevant to the question of whether the order appealed from is erroneous. So I would suggest the part related to the parallel evidence rule and whether judgment on the pleadings should have been granted on our equitable mortgage claim is relevant to the grant of the preliminary injunction. I would say that the unconscionability claim ought not to be reviewed by this court because that's not a matter relevant to the injunction in this case. But I do think this court should interpret, this court has given itself broad discretionary authority to review all matters relevant to a properly appealed order. And I think this court should be protective of that discretion and interpret that statute broadly. As Mr. Rishi said, it's much broader than even 26A7 appeals from judgments. It just has to be relevant.
So, Mr. Parsons, you obviously made an intentional decision to pursue the injunction under the equitable mortgage, not the unconscionability. There's some overlap in those theories.
There are.
Can you talk about maybe the distinctions and why maybe the equitable mortgage may be more applicable to the unconscionability, or why unconscionability may still matter in this case?
Well, the preliminary injunction itself was on the equitable mortgage claim, as I understand it. And so the unconscionability claim, it's relevant, I guess, and we're not necessarily opposed to the court addressing that claim if it would like to in this proceeding. Clearly, the preliminary judgment on the pleadings on the equitable mortgage claim is relevant to the order appealed from. So we're not really contesting this court's jurisdiction. I do think there's a distinction on the unconscionability, but if this court wishes to review that, then I think it has the discretion to do it. I think its discretion is broad here for appellate jurisdiction. So I'd like to talk about the parallel evidence rule in the statute, which really just SDCL 5385, which really just says that an executed contract supersedes all oral negotiations. That statute was adopted as part of the Dakota Territorial Code in 1887 and has not changed since. So it was in effect at the time of this court's decision in Wilson versus McWilliams in 1902 and on into the 21st century with Adrian versus McKinney and Myers versus Ike. And that statute did not preclude the court from examining extrinsic evidence in those cases, and it does not do so here because the allegation itself is that the papers, no matter how cleverly they've been drafted and crafted, amount to a constructive fraud. They are not necessarily ambiguous. What they are is they are a disguise. They are a device to disguise the true intent of the parties. It's akin to a fraudulent inducement type of claim or other claims where you can look at extrinsic evidence. The claim here is that the intent of the parties at the outset was this to be a security device. The papers are a security device to secure the money that is being loaned by Sioux County Ranch to the Sturzenbeckers to clear title on their property, and that the subsequent lease agreement with the option to repurchase is the classic device, going back two centuries at least, two or three centuries, to disguise it.
This is not a classic equitable mortgage scenario. The Sturgeonbeckers were not in any kind of financial trouble vis-a-vis Sioux County. They wanted, however, an opportunity, which I can appreciate. It is a very noble and commendable, you know, idea that they had to consolidate and get this family farm. I get that. Probably very near and dear to their hearts. But they weren't in trouble as it relates to anyone. In fact, Judy was going to be a millionaire when this land was distributed. So it sets up a lot differently, would you agree, than the typical, prototypical equitable mortgage
situation? It's certainly not the prototypical mortgage where there is a debt that is cleared. I agree with that to that extent. But it's, in effect, the same, because what this money was needed to do was to clear title to preserve possession of the farm by the Sturzenbecker family.
What do you mean, say clear title? What do you mean, clear title?
Because the title to the land was in the trust, and the trust was going to sell the land on the open market.
Yeah. So buy it.
Yeah. Correct. So this was needed.
But it wasn't encumbered or anything. They didn't need it to clear it, like clear an encumbrance or something like that.
Well, I would say it was encumbered because the Sturzenbeckers, as the record will show, were unable to obtain any financing, although they had at least $1 million worth of equity in this land. Banks would not loan them money because it was tied up in this trust. They could not secure financing except from a distressed lender, Sioux County Ranch.
So I wanted to ask you about the equity in the property. I mean, that's one of the conspicuous elements of an equitable mortgage, is there's equity in the property,
right,
which is what creates the grounds for an equitable mortgage. I understand after the fact this property may have increased, but at the time, was there any evidence that the $4.1 million or whatever it was not fair market value of the property?
Yeah, I think there's some indication in the testimony that it was a family price, a below market price, $4.1 million. But of course, that's not what Sioux County bought the property for. They bought it for even $1 million less than what Judy paid for the property 5 minutes earlier or 2 minutes earlier. Basically, they loaned Judy $2 million approximately, and then got title to the property and $1 million from Judy. So their contention is, we bought this property for $3 million 2 minutes after she bought it for $4 million plus dollars. That's not credible. That's a security device. I mean, that's clear intent.
Doesn't it have to be tempered with the idea that Cody himself had the opportunity to buy it at the end of the lease for $3.8 million? So if 4.2 isn't the right number, and I agree that 3.1 is lower than 3.8, but 3.8 is still lower than 4.2. And in the meantime, if as some of the testimony from the hearing suggests, the property is increasing in value steadily, and that would be a big boon to Cody to be able to buy that land at $3.8 million. So there's that.
$3.8 million, which is, yeah, more than the Sturzenbeckers purportedly sold it to Sioux County for, and that's interest on the loan.
What's their fee? I mean, we don't really scrutinize fees in private agreements.
Fees and interest, fee and interest on the loan, that's their processing fee, and there are fees charged in some of these other cases too. That's how it's disguised. $10,000 fee, I think, in Adrian versus McKinney. But then, of course, the other compelling evidence was that less than a year later, about a year later, after Sioux County bought the land, they say, from Judy, the Sturzenbeckers, for $3.1 million, they offered to sell it back to her for $6.5 million. Oh, now we have the land, now we have title, we'll sell it back to you, yeah, if you can come up with $6.5 million in a week, and we keep all the rent. So, of course, obviously, my clients are sheep farmers and hay farmers and didn't have the money to do that at all. Now they've signed away their title for nothing, given them $1 million for nothing, and they're going to auction it off. They find it on the internet, and what was the testimony? This property could fetch $7 million 1 year after Judy sold it for $3.1 million purportedly to Sioux County. The value of the property did not double in a year. This was a disguised mortgage, and that's one of the clear factors in Ike and the Myers versus Ike and Adrian versus McKinney, is that this property is worth much, much more. This was a fully secured, high-interest loan with zero risk to Sioux County, where even under the terms of the agreement themselves, they were going to make a 43% profit. Don't weep for Sioux County. This mortgage, if this court affirms, and ultimately there's a finding that this is an equitable mortgage, they will get paid back every penny plus 43% profit.
But why would we scrutinize that? Why would that matter? These parties were not otherwise connected with each other. They weren't indebted to Sioux County. They found Sioux County, and Sioux County gave them an opportunity to buy a $7 million tract of land for $3.8 million in 5 years. So it didn't work. It was, and I understand that, and that's unfortunate. But why would we say, well, shame on Sioux County for trying to make money or not having enough risk in this? They didn't have to do any of it.
You would say it because this court sits in equity and it scrutinizes the true intent of the parties at the beginning of this relationship.
Do we sit in equity when there is otherwise an agreement that would provide legal recourse and clarity in terms of the parties' rights and obligations? What is the gateway that would allow us to say we're now exercising equitable power, even in the midst of an agreement and in a series of agreements that characterize in each step of this multifaceted agreement? Why? What is our equitable jurisdiction? What leads us to that?
The gateway is centuries of English common law that recognize this claim. United States Supreme Court, dozens of cases, the United States Supreme Court say that when you scrutinize these arrangements, no matter what form the paper, the conveyance takes. This court said in Wilson, 1902, whenever property is transferred, no matter in what form or by what conveyance, no matter what the papers, no matter how thick they are, as mere security for a debt. So you need evidence that this was really security for a debt. That was the intent of the parties. No matter what, the transferee takes merely as a mortgagee and has no other rights or remedies other than what the law accords to mortgagees. This court said in Myers, this rule is inflexible. Inflexible. Once a mortgage, always a mortgage.
Do you agree that in Myers versus Ike and in Adrian versus McKinney, they were characterized by much less certainty in terms of the documents that would evidence the transaction as compared to this one?
I would say, yeah, the lawyers were a lot better in this case. Yeah, absolutely. The lawyers separated out into five different documents, all signed at exactly the same time. Yeah, this was very cleverly crafted, much more so than in 1902 or some of these other cases, but that doesn't matter. What matters is the intent of the parties at the time that this happened. And if this court reads the testimony in this case, as I know it will, what the Sturzenbeckers were instructed and assured is the only reason we don't want this land, we don't buy land, the only reason we have to have title is so we can borrow the money to give you the money. And you're going to keep the land, you keep possession, you keep farming it, you pay the taxes, you pay the insurance, you lease it out if you want to. And after 5 years, this was described as a five-year loan to the Sturzenbeckers. After 5 years, you give us back the principal, you're paying interest every year through rent, you get it back, and that's all we're here to help you. This is why we help distressed farmers, that's what we do.
Mr. Parsons, Justice Salter alluded to this, of, you know, when do we apply equity? I mean, you talked about a legion of cases. We've got a legion of cases that talk about when you've got a contract, unambiguous, you look at the four corners, you don't look at anything else. This equitable mortgage concepts, and we also have cases that say when you have a plain and unambiguous agreement, we don't apply equity. Equitable mortgage seems to be this unique feature, but when is it appropriate for a court to apply that when we've got, you know, parties, arm's length agreement, they've got attorneys, They entered into this agreement, and we all of a sudden jump in and say, no, we're going to apply equity.
Equity, this court has jurisdiction to examine equity when it's invoked. And this court has firmly rooted traditional authority under English common law and the common law of this state.
But there's some real tension in our cases, our contract cases and our equitable mortgage cases. Would you agree?
I would say there's not tension in the equitable mortgage cases. Those cases are somewhat in tension with some other contract, yes. But they're always, when you're talking about, this court will always look at extrinsic evidence, not only if it's ambiguous, but if there's fraud in the inducement. And that's essentially the claim, that this is a constructive fraud. And so what was the true intent? No matter how you paper it over. Now, I mean, otherwise, you're giving, here's how you write it, just write it this way, and even if you intended a mortgage, you intended a security device, if your lawyers are good enough, if you write it this way, doesn't matter.
So what you're saying is this type of a transaction can never survive an equitable mortgage claim?
That's correct, Your Honor. If the true intent of the parties was that this be a mortgage, absolutely correct, Your Honor. And thank goodness we have courts to decide that.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Because this purchase agreement has an integration clause, aren't we statutorily prohibited from going outside the document to create an ambiguity in light of that?
No, for the reasons I believe I've explained, Your Honor. The court is instructed under its common law to look at the true intent of the parties, all the surrounding circumstances, no matter the form or by what conveyance. That's what this court has always done since it became a court. That's what the United States Supreme Court does, no matter how many papers are covering a transaction. And that's what this court should do. And this circuit judge heard all the evidence, made very strong credibility findings on our side and against the other side. And unfortunately, the two owners of Sioux County Ranch have since passed away after the evidentiary hearing, so the evidence isn't going to change on that.
Yeah, one quick.
Go ahead.
If we affirm, then no one should ever, from a seller standpoint or from a Sioux County standpoint or a lender's, whatever, buyer standpoint, they should never do these deals ever again if we affirm. And they should only ever, well, they should never do them. They should never even try to do them.
Well.
Yes.
Not if they're going to use it as a fraud. Not if they're going to try to cover up what the true intent is. They certainly should not, ethically or legally, should not enter into those agreements. Because if what it is a security device, that's what you have to call it. A mortgage is a mortgage, and it never changes. That rule is inflexible, Your Honor.
It wasn't really much of a question. I probably
it was a commentary, but that's okay.
So if this court affirms, to answer your other question, if this court affirms, the preliminary injunction will stand. The land will not be auctioned off to the highest bidder, and we'll have some more evidence in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Rishi, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start off with Justice Salter's comment first, because what we're talking about is a completely lawful agreement, right? Parties enter into purchase, lease backs with an option, I think regularly. I don't do transactions, but it's agreements we've heard of, right? And so, effectively, if this court says that this was indeed an equitable mortgage, then these agreements are illegal, unenforceable, because any party could always say if it didn't work out, well, geez, that's not what I meant.
Well, but that's not really what the claim is here. Isn't the claim not that it's necessarily void or illegal, but that you just can't treat it as a purchase agreement when it's really a funding device, and Sioux County still stands to make the lender fee, if you want to call it, interest rate, whatever you want to call it. They still stand to make that. That's still there.
Let me put it this way. If Judy Sturzenbecker and Sioux County Ranch truly intended the agreement as it's structured in the documents, which I believe they did, what more should Bob Hayes and Mike Fink, her attorney, have done to put it in writing so that this court it would be insulated from an equitable mortgage claim. Should there be a third document that says, no, seriously, what we put in the real estate purchase agreement was our actual intent and how it's...
The reason underlying the idea that people use to memorialize their agreements is clarity and certainty. And it's interesting in this case because, and this whole area, is that the argument, you know, for the equitable mortgage doctrine is, hey, throw that out. It's not even unambiguous, or it's not even ambiguous, but just throw it out. So if a lawyer goes to great care to memorialize an agreement and write it, and still it doesn't provide the level of certainty, no matter how the case turns out, one way or the other, but it doesn't provide the level of certainty that we would typically associate with careful drafting, why do it?
And, you know, this is an agreement that is required by law to be in writing. And what the appellees want the court to say is, even though the state requires it to be in writing, and the state tells you if it's in writing it should be respected, there will always be this uncertainty if the other party wants to invoke equitable mortgage.
Well, of course, if it really wasn't a mortgage or a security arrangement, then presumably the extrinsic evidence would not show that. What about the scenario where it truly is a fraud, and that's what's being argued here? Should parties not have the opportunity, regardless of how well the documents are prepared, to ever bring such a claim?
I think, Your Honor, when you look at the evidence in this case, it's not clear at all that there was any constructive fraud or otherwise, that the party's intent was not as reflected in the documents.
Well, indeed, I have looked at it. I think there's a considerable amount of evidence that might suggest that. But that's not, you know, the question that I asked here, which is, you know, what seems to be being discussed here is whether there should ever be this remedy, this potential.
Well, I guess if there is actual fraud, then the party could still bring a fraud in the inducement case, right? There could still be a actual fraud claim that is brought that could
provide... So you think
provide.
That's different?
I do think that's different because, you know, Mr. Parsons is saying, well, it's a constructive fraud. Who's being defrauded here? The testimony of the Sturzenbeckers was they told us they needed to hold title. What does hold title mean? It means to own the property. And even if they didn't understand that in 2020 when they were starting to think about this, I'm certain Mike Fink does. Their attorney, and I go back to that story that I started with. They sat in Mike Fink's office. They reviewed these agreements. His testimony is that he assisted them with this transaction. If they didn't understand what was going on, they had the opportunity, they had the counsel, they had every reason to not move forward if they didn't believe that these documents reflected the agreement. And what happened is, they really wanted all of this property, not just the 1/4 interest that Judy Sturzenbecker was entitled to as a beneficiary of the state. They wanted all this property, and so they entered into this agreement that got Cody the opportunity to purchase that property, and it didn't work out. And, Your Honor, that is not an excuse to just throw out the agreement. We ask that the court vacate the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rishi. Thank you, counsel, for your fine arguments. We're in resource for attending.